Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Jam-packed show coming up for you today. We go a little bit beneath the surface of typical retail because we're going to talk about Ingles Markets. We're also going to talk about Conn's Furniture, which is a business that we've never discussed on the podcast in the past. And we'll talk about earnings from Casey's General Stores. So we hit a little bit of everything. Our interview guest, Rob McGovern, he is the CEO and founder of Precise Target, which is a platform basically designed to ascertain the retail tastes of Americans and connecting retailers with those consumers. He's got a lot of interesting things to say about the future of apparel retail, especially as it pertains to merchandise turns. A reminder, you can like us or rate us on any podcast listening service, whether that be Apple Podcast, Spotify, Podcast Addict, Podcast Republic. Your ratings help out. They help others find the show. If you don't want to help others find the show, well, I guess you can not leave a rating. That's certainly an option there. You can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. If you listened to the last episode of the show, we've got pictures up from Leighton's visit to a Redwood City, California Kmart on that Instagram page. All right, we're going to start the show this week with a regional grocer in Ingles Markets after starting the show with a national grocery powerhouse in Kroger. If you're not familiar with Ingles Markets, they are a regional grocery chain, mostly in the southeastern United States. And one of the interesting things about this and about what we'll be talking about is, first, they're in a grocery hotbed in the southeastern United States where there's a lot of companies clamoring for market share right now. And two, they actually own their own dairy products company. And dairy is something that's actually going to show up heavily in this week's show after we just mentioned dairy inflation on Kroger's front last week. Now, again, Ingles just released earnings. The headline on the company release surrounding the earnings call trumpeted, and I quote, "Ingles Markets Incorporated reports record sales for fiscal 2019. And yes, that was in all caps. It's also technically true. On that note, it's important to mention that this was their fourth quarter earnings call, so full year numbers were locked in as well. That's one big reason why we're mentioning them on the podcast this week, is so we can kind of cover everything in one go for Ingles.
This is typically the spot, Trent, in the story where we tell you about the analyst estimates coming into the call. Well, there aren't any. Not for this particular case. Not a single analyst from Zach Sweep had a forecast for Ingles. All that being said, they came in with $1.04 in adjusted earnings per share for the fourth quarter, which for them ended back in September for everyone's time frame here. Is this good? Well, maybe it is an improvement over the fourth quarter of 2018. As you see, also net income as a whole was up 13.6% for the fourth quarter year over year. This was partially a product of increased sales overall, but also because they were able to extract greater margin on those improved sales. So more sales, more margin, more net income year over year. As a result, those double digits, by the way, Trent, kind of exceeded our own expectation. We're talking about analyst expectation. Occasionally, we can consider ourselves maybe not only retail fans, but maybe some on the sideline analysts. But for those overall sales, they were up by $20 million over last year, Trent, an increase of around 1.9%, which is actually, I should say, I just looked at an inflation report. It's about 1.8% right now. So that would be a tiny bit higher, about 10 basis points higher than the current inflation metrics would have you believe. So it appears that overall sales would have improved by a greater amount as comps excluding gasoline did increase 3.7%. Gasoline prices being down slightly, by the way, and the closure of a handful of locations, including two in Gwinnett, Georgia, and one in Calhoun, Georgia, also negatively impacted top-line revenue. They have a net of two stores fewer right now than they did 1 year ago, 198 stores versus the 200 they had last year. That 3.7% is quite remarkable, we should say, given an atmosphere where the heavy hitters are hitting around 2 to 3% in terms of top line revenue increases. However, this is in line with what Ingles had experienced for the full year, with overall 2019 comps up 3.9%. Needless to say, a solid year overall for the grocer.
Ingalls is infamous for not releasing much information during their earnings reports, so we had to dig a little bit deeper as far as where the increases in profits are exactly coming from. And thanks to Trent for all of this homework, SG&A was down ever so slightly as a percentage of sales, just about 19 basis points. So it doesn't appear as though it played a major role in the increase of earnings per share. There was a slight actual dollar increase for SG&A stemming from labor cost increases, nor should the credit go to their gross profit margin, which was nearly the exact same at 24.2% in this year's fourth quarter as it was in last year's. Instead, it appears as though much of the benefit was extracted from the closed stores. They banked just under $500,000 from the gain from sale or disposal of the assets in this latest quarter. During the same time, they did see a decrease in rent expense by around $200,000. Between these two impacts, plus around $400,000 less in interest expense, we're looking at almost half of their around $2.5 million jump in net income. For the year as a whole, their pre-tax net income jumped to an even greater extent by $26.3 million, or a whopping, Trent, 32.7%.
And so, because there aren't any earnings calls for Ingalls, we had to look a little bit deeper, just like with the earnings part of this, to see what some initiatives are that we're looking at for Ingalls. We got to look at regional newspapers, the like, and again, they're just based outside of Asheville, North Carolina. Worth it, by the way, to give a shout to their lead dietitian, Leah McGrath, who was a former podcast guest of ours, but not included in their earnings calls, and I think this is interesting, are results from Milk Co. So I mentioned earlier, they actually own their own dairy company. Milk Co. is a wholly owned dairy subsidiary it bought in 1982. And again, we don't get numbers specifically from Milk Co. on these earnings reports. Interestingly, though, when you look at Milk Co., their production continues to increase, even as overall demand for dairy products wanes. To that point, an article we actually posted on our Twitter feed at Retail Podcast from Transport Topics News suggests that freighters are actually not seeing a fall off as a result of non-dairy alternatives. Part of that is because they're using the same freighters to deliver those non-dairy alternatives. Still, U.S. milk sales fell around 7.5% from 2017 to 2018. Of course, we don't have full year numbers yet for 2019. That's something that we should have here in just a few weeks. This is not inclusive of all dairy products. This is just inclusive of milk. And we'll actually talk about some momentum in other areas like cheese a little bit later on in terms of sale prices. Even with those sales falling for milk 7.5% over the last year, sales are projected by Nielsen to fall just 2.4% in 2019 from 2018. And adjacent to Milk Co., there's the entire issue of Dean Foods declaring bankruptcy. Now, if you haven't seen anything from this story, again, this is something that came out about a month ago, and there's a lot to parse in this situation for Dean Foods, including the possibility that they'll end up actually in the hands of Dairy Farmers of America. There was a New York Times article this week about whether or not that might be a good thing for dairy farmers as a whole or for the dairy industry, because Dairy Farmers of America at that point would hold very close to a monopoly in terms of milk distribution in the U.S. Still, looking back at Dean now, closing plants in Milk Co.'s wheelhouse, most notably ones in Kentucky and Georgia, really opens it up for Milk Co., again, wholly owned subsidiary of Ingalls, to take available market share in those areas. And it's pertinent to mention Milk Co. does not only provide to Ingalls. It's not just a company that they have in their portfolio simply to provide dairy products to themselves, but they also provide dairy products to food service distributors, wholesalers, and independent grocers as well. So with Dean shrinking and milk production in the U.S. still strong, so we're talking about production here, not sales, it's up on a monthly basis 15%, in fact, over the last 9 years, partially because of advancements in technology, advancements in breeding programs as well, it sets up for Milk Co. to benefit. So on one hand, you have fairly robust supply, but on the other hand, with Dean Foods kind of shrinking and scaling back and closing some of their plants throughout the country, offers an opportunity for Milk Co. to go above and beyond their traditional Ingalls stores to be able to market some of that dairy. Aside from current developments, by the way, and we're going to move on from milk Ingles was one of the companies to capitalize on Kmart closures. It is known that they purchased, for example, an older Kmart on Patton Avenue in Asheville, North Carolina, for around $8.5 million this year. However, earlier this week in the Asheville Citizen Times, Ingles CFO Ron Freeman said they actually have no immediate plans for the site. So they bought this old Kmart, but nothing immediately in the pipeline. And we found this odd, and the reason we're bringing it up here, he was quoted earlier in the year as saying that they look forward to a redevelopment there at a future date. So it sounds like they're looking now well into the future for redevelopment. And Leighton, as you know, having vacant property on the books usually isn't ideal, as it comes with a lot of property maintenance costs and the like to try and keep it up to code, although they may get a bit of a tax benefit from depreciation there.
Perhaps the only other thing to note, Trent, they installed banana ripening rooms in their loan distribution center, which is something we don't talk about often on the podcast. But speaking of distribution centers, remember those Gwinnett locations we mentioned earlier that were closed by Ingles that were perhaps underperforming or really dragging down their balance sheet? They were really two of the furthest locations from this loan distribution center. So it makes sense logistically to have closed them. They put a lot of pride in the fact that their DC is within 250 miles only of their entire store base, Trent. With an operation on the smaller end, they are always looking to keep freight costs in check, especially those we've seen recently go up for most retailers for a variety of reasons. They actually have a backhaul program in place that allows their trucks to pick up merchandise on the way back from deliveries, which is certainly indicative of their efforts to minimize costs and create multiple efficiencies. We head to the convenience store segment now as rapidly expanding Midwest operator Casey's General Store released earnings this week. Casey's, publicly owned company, and we see that this company has been on our news line for quite some time now, but we haven't really talked about them much this year. But for this latest earnings call, it was for 2020's second quarter, as Casey's is offset somewhat from the typical financial calendar. Expectations from Wall Street came in at $2.10 per share, and Casey's provided a mildly positive surprise with adjusted earnings per share of $2.21 for the quarter. So that's an 11 cent difference between expectations there. In our coverage of the story, we're going to spend most of our time discussing in-store developments because, as we'll note, in-store processes and operations are extremely important for general stores now. It is not just about gasoline and having prepared foods. It's going to be about having fresh foods, having produce, having really good merchandising to go along with all of that newer type of food product. So it is interesting because same store gallons were down 1.8% and margin was also down slightly versus prior quarters, though up year over year for Casey's. But total gross profit on fuel was up as a result of Casey's massive continued location expansion efforts. The increase year over year was credited to their Price Advantage price optimization tool. And if you look, this is similar to what Kroger has experienced in utilizing their own price optimization tool. We'll dig into the numbers now. And as far as the grocery and other merchandise, same store sales were up a robust 3.2% in large part to the efforts that I just mentioned. They break out margin on their calls, and the average merchandise margin for this segment was a whopping 33.3%. This was up a full percentage point from the prior quarter. CEO Darren Rebelez credited a continual company shift to higher margin products. Additionally, they rolled out new internal price optimization tools that will, in theory, allow them to charge more for products where the marketplace can uphold it. This would indicate that the increase in same-store sales was likely a larger basket size increase owing to slightly higher price points rather than traffic. So for the quarter as a whole, their sales in grocery and other merchandise segment was up 6.8% year over year, partially from the same store sales increase, which I just mentioned, and partially from new and acquired stores for their store base. This was despite a massive impact from cigarette sales, a negative impact, we should note, 260 basis point negative impact. In fact, indeed, same store sales in grocery and other merchandise would have increased 5.8%, excluding the impact of cigarette sales, or lack thereof in this case. And I talked about how recently Sam's Club is actually experiencing a larger negative impact from reduced cigarette sales to their convenience store network. A lot of convenience stores actually do buy in bulk from Sam's Club, and cigarettes used to be a large percentage
of their basket. But this makes sense that the impact would be magnified for a massive operator like Casey's, who, as we mentioned, is still in growth mode.
Now let's move from the center of that Casey's convenience store to the edges. As far as their prepared food and fountain segment, those sales weren't up by quite as much. In fact, same store sales in this category rose by 1.9%. They had expected for the year same store sales to rise by about 3-6%. This came in well below that. Average margin, meanwhile, was still pretty solid, 60.9%, much higher than the center of the store, of course, since this number doesn't take into account facets such as equipment maintenance and the like. However, this margin percentage was down over a year ago, so higher than center store items, but down over a year ago in that food and fountain segment due to cheese costs, actually. So again, with the dairy inflation, we've talked about dairy a lot over the last couple of weeks, but it's again because companies are looking at this as part of an issue eroding margins. In the case of Casey's, the reason this is so pertinent is because of their increasing pizza production. They put a lot more marketing into their pizza production, and the fact that they are, according to the tagline, and I quote, famous for pizza. But the reality of it is, we'll talk about the markets for Casey's here in just a little bit and why that pizza production is so important. Now, Rebel has noted that the average cost of a pound of cheese to them was $2.18 this year as compared to $1.86 in previous years. So barring a massive increase in the price of wheat, cheese costs are going to be your main cost in creating a pizza. And if you've ever had a pizza from Casey's, you'll know there is quite a bit of cheese on that pizza. So this, of course, is going to make a huge impact for them. And again, one has to wonder why we're seeing this inflation in a world of rising supply. I just talked about how there is more milk production year over year, and really that's increased over the last 9 years, while we are seeing falling demand in dairy. One suggestion might be because of freight costs. We've noted freight costs going up for just about everyone. Of course, that's going to touch the milk or dairy industry as a whole as well. Anyhow, Casey's is currently purchasing cheese on the spot market. As such, always looking for opportunities to kind of stockpile reserves of that cheese at a good price. Now, as far as overall sales are concerned, this is going above and beyond margin. Sales were up 5.2% in this particular category. Now, as far as firm-wide operating expenses are concerned, because we kind of broke it down, gasoline, center of the store, prepared food, that type of thing, firm-wide operating expenses were actually up pretty significantly. And although we can look at the raw number to say, well, yeah, it was up by a big margin year over year, we have to keep in mind that there are 84 more stores in their system than there were a year ago. But even when you break it down on a store-by-store level, operating expenses actually went up by a whopping 3.4% for stores open at least a year. That is a massive increase for anyone in the retail landscape. Usually, you know, on a lot of earnings calls that we look at, on a lot of data that we look at for stores, you're not seeing this massive jump. A lot of people are seeing slightly smaller jumps, you know, 1-2% because of maybe utility costs or because of labor. 3.4% is pretty large. And by the way, this is also exclusive of credit card fees, which can be substantial for a C-store. Also includes favorable impacts from lower insurance costs. And going back to that labor facet of things, actually includes favorable impacts from employee hours as well. They've been working on what they call hours management, basically ensuring that the stores are not unduly overstaffed during certain times. But even with these efforts, costs were up. And they didn't really speak as to why, actually, during the remarks. They did say that their hours management program, they said this on the actual call itself, on the conference call, they said it should continue to yield favorable results as time goes on and as their data set grows. I did want to take the time to talk about a few chain-wide initiatives. I'll kind of talk about the first couple, and then Layton will kind of pick up from there. A constant topic of conversation for Casey's is expansion, and it was no different on this call. Just in this quarter alone, they saw a net of 35 new stores added to their system. In the past, Casey's has developed from both acquisition and organic expansion. And they see calendar year 2020 being no different for them. They already have 12 stores under agreement to acquire and push into their pipeline. Additionally, they have a new store construction pipeline of 97 total sites, 31 of which are under construction currently. For this fiscal year, they're looking to build 60 stores. So some of those stores in that pipeline, that 97 site pipeline that I talked about, will be saved for future years. They're also looking to acquire 25 stores. So that's something of note. If you live in the Midwest, some of their acquisition stores have yet to be found, essentially. So you might see some branding changing on C-stores near you. Allowing their expansion is actually the construction of a new distribution center in Joplin, Missouri. And this is why I wanted to kind of delve a little bit more deeply, and Layton will talk about some of the other initiatives they've got. But I've traveled a lot near the Joplin, Missouri area. I'm very familiar with that area. And this Joplin site, they feel, will provide efficiencies that they're unable to attain in their current system by adding this warehouse space, but also by reallocating some work from the other warehouses. They feel as though this dramatically increases their white space to expand in new and existing markets, because right now they have warehouses that are, you know, 4-5 hours by semi away from certain Casey's stores that with this Joplin distribution center will now just be an hour or two drive. So it's going to make it more efficient. They project that this distribution center will be able to serve 500 stores in all. Joplin, by the way, that's a market that Casey's has bought their way into over the last decade or so. Going back 15 years ago, you didn't see a lot of Casey's locations in Joplin specific. You saw some of the locations in the outlying areas, some of the rural towns there, but they actually acquired several locations from local chain Fast Trip and rebranded those as Casey's about a decade or so ago. Now, they estimate the completion of this DC should be around spring 21. Important to keep that date in mind, spring 2021. Groundbreaking this month, actually. However, it's worth noting that this DC likely wouldn't be coming to fruition if not for a recent highway expansion. And this is something that we don't often look at, but it's another reason why retail is so intertwined with just about everything that's going on in the marketplace. So I wanted to take just a second to look at this highway expansion. For a Midwest or Plains chain such as Casey's, road transportation mechanisms are extremely important because you have a longer distance to go. Now, if you live on the coast, we know from our listenership numbers, a lot of our listeners from New York, from California, from Florida, those areas, you know, honestly, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump from the next town. You might have traffic to deal with, but in terms of mileage, not looking at a ton of mileage. But once you get into the Midwest, once you get into the areas that Casey's serves, you're looking at a 20 to 30 mile difference between towns. So your distribution network is crucial, and building out these DCs is crucial, but also making sure that those DCs are centered around transportation trends. To this point, Joplin, Missouri is kind of the epicenter of this I-49 expansion project. Now, I-49 didn't exist as of about 15 years ago. The idea is eventually to connect New Orleans to Kansas City going north. Some of it's using existing highways, but in particular, around the Joplin area, they've managed to retrofit what was known as US 71 into I-49. That connection is already built from Kansas City south to Joplin. Honestly, this distribution center isn't going to have to serve that far north of Kansas City or too much further north of Kansas City because they've got their main DCs and their main headquarters in Ankeny, Iowa, which is just north of Des Moines. But when you look at the southerly portion of I-49, this is where it becomes crucial for Casey's because, again, based in Iowa, you see a lot of them around the Midwest, upper Great Plains, that type of area. But they're looking at expanding perhaps more southerly, and this distribution center will allow them to do that as the I-49 project continues. And I told you to keep in mind that spring 2021 date. The reason being is because that is also the rough time frame wherein I-49's connection south of Bentonville, Arkansas, also Walmart headquarters located there, is projected to be complete. Reason that's a big issue is because currently Highway 71, just for those that don't know and don't want to look at a map, cuts through the Ozarks. It's a very hilly, windy road, but it goes through specifically Bella Vista and North Bentonville, Arkansas. The problem with this is Bella Vista is a town that has grown by leaps and bounds, and there's not really a way to expand the current highway. So they're actually changing the highway configuration over. That configuration is expected to be done to allow full interstate capability from Joplin all the way down to Fort Smith, Arkansas, by 2021. And you can tell just by looking at the writing on the wall that Casey's is also planning on this being done so that they can expand further into the South, because they're seeing success in markets further south of where they're based at in Iowa. So I'm sorry, I went on a big deviation there, but just kind of interesting how retail and retail planning, in the case of convenience stores and Casey's, kind of mirrors the planning on the interstate system. And you don't see many new interstates being constructed these days, so it's kind of one of the few times we get to look at kind of the confluence of different projects between retail and the highway system.
I just wanted to take a few moments to end on a couple new things for the company. Back to that price optimization tool that I had discussed earlier, we didn't get into too much detail as to how that's being rolled out or to where that's being rolled out, so I'll get into those details right now. They performed a gradual center store rollout with the platform earlier in the quarter. So products such as packaged foods and snacks, candy bars, that kind of thing, are now covered by the platform, but the rollout isn't complete yet. We should end with that caveat. The next products to be included in the system, however, will be beer, where applicable, alcohol, hard alcohol, for instance, in Missouri, that's a state where it's sold in convenience stores, as an example. So they're going to be rolling that out as regulated by state and local governments. This is an interesting development because it hasn't been that long since several states had regulations controlling prices on alcohol and liquor. So looking at that price optimization tool, prices are no longer going to be firm fixed, as they say in supply chain management. Next up, they plan on adding cigarettes and some of their prepared food lines to the platform. They were transparent that the tool is still in its infancy, and they don't have too much in the way of data to discuss on the call. So they weren't able to get into the details of what data they're looking at and how, from that data, they're then changing prices of the products in store. Another new development for Casey's is the continued rollout of the rewards program. Most established convenience store chains, such as Come & Go, Quick Trip, among others, either have current rewards programs or abandon them at some point, and maybe they have different iterations of them as well. So Casey's is actually looking to join the rewards group now, having piloted a program in some markets that allows their customers, or guests as they call them, to collect points that can be redeemed for in-store purchases or even fuel discounts, which is a common theme for convenience stores with gasoline. So they rolled this out to certain employees at first, which in doing so is more of a very small rollout, but then they did a limited soft launch at the beginning of December. One interesting facet to the program is that customers can opt to turn these points not only into maybe purchases in store or gasoline discounts, but into a donation to their local school. The company says this tested very well, and they hope to have it serve as a differentiator. And that certainly is something that we do not see from other convenience stores with rewards programs. So that is a very good thing in terms of PR and for just having the customer do whatever they want with the points. So a main difference between Casey's and most other large convenience store chains is that Casey's does far more business in small or mid-sized markets. So if you drive through the Midwest, as Trent pointed out, it is not uncommon to see Casey's in towns of 1,000 or less, which is another reason why their prepared food proposition is so interesting. And most of these towns, by the way, do not have another restaurant, or at the very least, a pizza place. So this serves as both in some cases. These towns are often centered around their schools or school district. As such, Casey's main marketing spend in these towns really comes from the school donations or signage at sporting events that they sponsor. So not surprising to see them add this facet to the rewards program in terms of the overall ability to differentiate and donate those points to a particular school. It will be interesting to see how bookkeeping works for these donations in the future. By the way, from the accounting standpoint, the tax accounting standpoint, very interesting. One thing we'll be looking at. One negative for Casey's on the call was the reduced guidance for same-store sales. As far as grocery and other merchandise, they still expect to come in between 2.5% to 4% on the year as a whole. You know, it's pretty much half over now, but still decent metrics there, but it could be larger. However, they have reduced their prepared food and fountain expectations significantly from 3% to 6% increases originally down to 1.5% to 4% increases for the full year. So far,
they are on the lower end of that guidance. So they did reaffirm guidance on margins, which is a positive for the company, and increased by a half percentage point their expectations on fuel margins. So they're getting a little bit more there. Finally, during their investor day in January, they will be unveiling a new strategic plan that they've been working on. They noted on the call that the plan is geared towards long-term profitable growth. Again, growth is very much their MO right now, as it has been for about 15 years now. That will stay the same.
Coming up after this, we'll be joined by Rob McGovern. He's the CEO of Precise Target. He'll be talking not only about his platform, but about the changing dynamics of the way retailers reach consumers in the apparel and fashion space. Pleased to have the interviews back on the Retail Focus podcast this week. And this week, we're excited to be joined by Rob McGovern. He is the founder and chief executive officer of Precise Target. Precise Target, founded with the idea of ascertaining kind of the retail taste of Americans, but more importantly, connecting retailers and consumers. We're excited to talk to him not only about this technology, but about that facet of connecting retailers and consumers, specifically in apparel. Rob, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Hey, Trent, it's great to be here. I really enjoy your podcast.
Well, it's great to have you here. Now, just to kind of start out, because we haven't had you on the show before, we haven't talked about Precise Target on the show before. So if you could explain to our listeners exactly how the Precise Target platform is designed to work and kind of the overarching concept behind the founding of it.
Yeah, so you know, it all started with a goal to help retailers overcome the sparse data problem, right? You know, if you look at Amazon, a prime customer, they sell somewhere between 75 and 100 items per year per customer. The largest apparel retailer in the U.S. that's not Amazon sells 2 items per customer per year. And if you only know your customer by a belt and a pair of shoes, you really can't do much in making predictions. So my idea was, well, what if we pooled the data of all the retailers together and created a dense data set and gave everyone the same kind of machine knowledge that an Amazon would have? And so we did that, and it's been quite a journey. We've learned a lot, but we really are the company helping retailers and wholesale brands overcome the sparse data problem.
You mentioned that number, and I think that's really what stood out to me in kind of looking over the Precise Target platform, that 2 items per year. If you're an e-commerce apparel retailer and you're not Amazon, that's how many items you get to know your customers by. And I think you kind of tying that in, we've all had the experience of checking out at a brick and mortar retailer, spending 2 minutes or so giving them our information, or on an e-commerce website, and then for the next several months getting these daily emails or sometimes twice daily emails from that retailer. In my case, it seems like an awful lot of the time the emails are not targeted or are pushing products not even adjacent to the ones I would ever purchase. So from your perspective, where does this disconnect happen where, you know, they even have the 2 data points and it doesn't seem like they're even connecting on those 2, much less a more holistic picture, as you mentioned?
Yeah, perhaps I could start with sort of an oh my God moment that we had as a company. Our initial idea was, let's get everyone's data in one place. Let's build a machine learning system. And we really thought what was going to happen is we were going to learn who the customers are that like Anne Klein products or Under Armour products or Tommy Bahama products. And the first thing that we noticed in the data, and we looked at 5 billion transactions, is that consumers have very low affinity to product brands. In fact, for Gen Z and millennials, they're more likely to buy a different brand the next time. Not because they're unhappy, it's because they're novelty seekers. They like new things. And so we said, wow, the retailers are targeting people using an assumption that since they bought Cole Haan before, they'll buy it again. And the data says the repurchase rate is very low, almost indistinguishable. And for us, that was a moment of, wow, our business idea is blown. But then we took a step back and we said, what are we seeing in the data? And, you know, we're machine learners. We build an AI system, and the system said people buy things that are remarkably similar to the prior items. So, by way of example, the jeans in your closet are very similar to each other. Same price point, I'm guessing the same styles, colors, fit, but they're not the same brand. You have a collection of brands that fit your taste. And that was a realization. We said, wow, our understanding is people's tastes. And so we then went out to all the retailers and said, hey, give us a feed of your products every day. And we get hundreds and hundreds of these. And we fit them to a taste profile on every consumer. And then we tested it. And you know what happens? People buy in their taste. And it really works great for new acquisition of customers. It's when you're saying, I want to target people who have a taste for my product. We found that that will perform as well as people who know the product. And so what we're doing is we're taking a completely different approach. We're targeting people based on the attributes of the kinds of products they buy, not what they bought. Every retailer and every product brand, they're all in conference rooms trying to figure out how do we acquire new customers. And what we have learned is if you target potential new customers based on the taste of the consumers, that will work as well or better than targeting people who actually know the brand. And so for brands that want to expand their customer base, targeting for acquisition a different way really does work.
And I think one other important thing to note about your platform is because, again, you're basically assembling these profiles, but there's got to be a connection to that actual person. And I think anyone who's listening to this is probably thinking, you know, well, safety's a big concern because you're worried about that data getting out there. You guys have a partnership with Equifax, as I understand it, and that kind of serves to obfuscate the connection between the data and the person itself. Why is it important, as someone who manages just an absolute ton of data, to have that extra layer there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, we have profiles on 220 million U.S. adults. That's almost 99% of people. And our law firm is one of the biggest law firms in the country. And, you know, they wanted to come into a privacy review. And their lawyers came in and imagine the scene. It's like they're, you know, coming in with their gun holsters unclipped. And they're ready to tell us, we can't do what we do. And they spent hours reviewing what we're doing. And they stopped the meeting and said, you're the first company that's doing this right. We've never met a company that is doing privacy the right way. So the way we do it is, we created this membrane between us and the customer, and that's Equifax. And so we have an identifier for every consumer, but it's synthetic. We have a synthetic one for you, and Equifax keeps the real identity. So what happens is if a retailer wants information about their client, they pass the request to Equifax, who sends a synthetic identifier to us and says, append the data to the synthetic ID for this person and send it back to Equifax, who then rematches it. So we have no way of ever discovering the identity of the consumer, but Equifax can be that trusted match partner between us and the retailer. And it passes GDPR, it passes CCPA, and it passes the lawyers who I don't think they ever have passed anyone before.
All part of course, what has to go into managing data in this day and age. Now, I want to go back to something that you discussed earlier. You were talking about basically there's this macro level trend where people aren't necessarily likely to buy a particular brand again, but they are likely to buy a particular style or a particular trend again. Now, again, Precise Target focuses on the individual shopper, which is part of what makes the company so interesting. But from your perch, you see a lot of macro level data like this. Above and beyond those findings, what are some of the more interesting things that you found as a company just on the macro level?
Yeah, so I would say there's some very interesting differences between millennials and Gen Z. Now, they're more than half the shopping audience now. 160 million people in Gen Z and millennial versus 160 40 million in boomers and Gen X. So they're becoming the meat of the market. And what's interesting is the millennials were the anti-store people. The Gen Z people like to go to the store, but they don't want your help. They'd much rather use a mobile phone than talk to a sales clerk. And so that's interesting to us is that we see different buying behaviors in these various cohorts, but the importance of online is the same for both. It's just one wants to do research online in the store, the other one would rather just not go to the store.
That's interesting, and you would think it would also perhaps somewhere on down the line maybe inform some of those store policies, procedures, things like that 10-foot rule, that type of thing that we hear so much about in store. Now, as a company, of course, as we've kind of touched on, your main focus is apparel, footwear, cosmetics, and so forth. But from your position, again, Precise Target CEO, what are some of the trends of this particular segment of retail that you're beginning to notice or that we can expect to see come to bear in the next decade beyond those demographic differences there?
Yeah, I think we're going to end up calling this era the programmatic retail era, right? So a way of analogy, advertising in the last 10 years has rolled over from being focused on creative to being focused on programmatic targeting. Right, the ad world now is controlled and run by algorithms who are determining which ads go to which people. And that's going to happen in retail. So we, in apparel, you know, in the old days, which were, let's call that 5 years ago, that we worked on 14-week assortment cycles. So winter lasted 14 weeks, then you brought your spring catalog out for 14 weeks, your summer catalog, your fall catalog, et cetera. Zara just announced they're down to 2 weeks. They roll over their assortment every 2 weeks. Now, if you're going to push cycle time that fast, you better not do it with people. And what's happening is we're entering an era where AI and programmatic help is going to be part of what we do. I don't know if you're familiar with the IBM system that won Jeopardy. It was a Deep Blue, I think. That system was the first system to beat the world champion in chess, Garry Kasparov. And, you know, everyone said, hey, the chess game is over because machines can win now. But that's actually not true. The world champion in chess is not Deep Blue. Actually, anytime you team a professional chess player with Deep Blue, they can beat Deep Blue. So there's a place for people in retail, but people are going to be supported by AI systems. And they're going to have to because the velocity is increasing at a very fast rate. You know, I think we're going to end up looking at two-week catalog cycles as slow someday.
And that's incredible, again, given perspective of, as you mentioned, where we've come from the four seasonal catalogs and that type of thing of the 20, 30 years ago. Now, there is one thing I wanted to wrap up on, and you kind of referenced this in your earlier answers, but I wanted to go back to demographic data. I think a lot of retailers, in fact, I was just talking to a retailer about a month ago who said that, you know, hey, market X wouldn't work for us because this is the demographic there. But one of the things that's interesting, I think, about Precise Target is you're really finding that it goes above and beyond the demographics. Just because you have customers in a certain demographic doesn't mean they're going to be buying the same things. So how important is it now for retailers to kind of parse this out and go just beyond the typical demographic measures?
Demographics is a 1980 strategy for retailers. I mean, let's just do a game. Let's stand in front of Macy's and watch 25-year-old women walk in the door. And we're going to say, wow, they're not the same people. They don't dress the same. They don't behave the same. And that's right. We have 500 taste segments per gender, right? And each person is the 1/500th. And so it really is far too coarse of a way to characterize a person. And people have unique tastes. And we found that if we can identify the taste of a consumer and target them, it doubles the performance over demographic. Works twice as good. And that makes sense, right? Because people buy based on their taste, not how old they are.
Absolutely. Once again, our guest, Rob McGovern, CEO, co-founder of Precise Target. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus Podcast. It's been a really enlightening conversation.
Thanks, Trent. It's been great. And together, we're going to help retailers get to the next place.
Well, we thank Rob once again for joining us. One thing I did want to mention, Precise Target's data products are available on LiveRamp and the major DSPs. So they are already available here. So if you did want to access that, or if you wanted to get a hold of Precise Target, you can certainly do so. Now, to move on to our final news story on this week's edition of the podcast, Comstock gets absolutely wrecked after a reduction in guidance on Tuesday before the bell. Now, a little bit about Conn's first. We haven't really talked about them to this point. They are based in a Houston suburb, the Woodlands, which is somewhat indicative of where their store base is centered. Now, they sell televisions, that type of thing, but where they make a lot of their money and what was focused on a lot on the call is financing and internal financing. Now, you can buy anything at a Conn's, but again, they're making their money off of financing these type of things to customers. Once again, they have a number of stores throughout a variety of different areas, some stretching into the Mountain West. So you see New Mexico, Colorado, for example, Arizona as well, but also into what's considered the American South. So Alabama, Georgia, and of course their home state in Texas. They have stores actually as far east as South Carolina and Virginia. So again, mostly these stores south of what you would consider the Mason-Dixon line there, but they were founded all the way back in 1890. And interestingly, on the call, they beat on analysts' earnings per share forecast by 9 cents, coming in at 61 cents versus Zacks' consensus estimates of 52 cents. In this case, though, if you were to look at the stock price, it's all about the all-important future guidance, which cost the company about 30% in market cap on Tuesday during trading. So people not too pleased with the guidance and not too pleased with some of the underlying numbers, even though earnings per share were affected favorably.
Yeah, as we dig into the earnings, it was clear that earnings per share was affected favorably by their consumer credit services division. And similar to Aaron's, they are actually seeing greater bottom line impact from their credit services than their retail segment. In fact, they produce a positive third quarter credit spread of 1,070 basis points, which in turn led to a positive credit segment income before taxes. And this was the first time in about 5.5 years, Trent, that Conn's has seen positive credit segment income before taxes. However, this is what took the headlines, is that we are the retail focus and not the consumer credit services podcast. On that note, retail sales struggled massively. We wondered in last week's Looking Ahead if Conn's could capitalize on increased consumer discretionary income versus their competitors, and it appears as though they could not. In fact, same-store sales came in at negative 8.4%, which includes e-commerce sales. They blame two main things for this pullback, Trent. First, impacts of underwriting adjustments. Second, and far more important to the story, unprecedented market dynamics within consumer electronics, or more accurately put, their failure to adjust to these market dynamics negatively impacted them. For instance, Best Buy's comp sales were even, and electronics during this last quarter, their portfolio of consumer electronics began to see lower than expected performance on credit services, actually not sales. In fact, the glut of online applicants and new store applicants for credit on these particular items at a lower credit spread caused worry for the company. And so they adjusted to maintain their 1,000 basis point spread in the credit services division. So as such, they took a big time 4-5% hit on same store sales as a result of this. Their view essentially is that they're willing to take a hit to retain profitability. They did manage to increase, however, overall net income and revenues as a result of their credit segment performance. However, top line revenue from non-credit divisions was down, owing mostly to retail sales. Retail sales were down year over year by about $6 million, though new stores provided a 700 basis point benefit against those falling same store sales. Indeed, electronics were down by the greatest extent. Over $60 million in sales in the quarter last year fell to just over $48 million this year, Home appliance sales were up dramatically, though, nearly an $11 million boost over the $79.5 million in sales from last year. Home office was slightly down, which we've seen in a number of different retail outlets, as was furniture and mattress segments. On the repair and service front, their commissions from repair service agreements were up. While service revenues were down slightly, the service division was a net positive, around $2.5 million over last year.
And one of the interesting things to note is Leighton mentioned appliances being up by such a large margin. That's something that we are seeing around the scope of retail. When you look at Best Buy's earnings that came out towards the end of November, you saw appliance comp sales up 12.5% there. But again, consumer electronics were mostly flat for them. So something to kind of keep in mind there as you look at cons and kind of comparing and contrasting where they sit as compared to the rest of the retail landscape. Now, we mentioned their stock fell due to guidance. A lot of this was because they expect now a change in total retail sales between -5% and -9% for the fourth quarter, where that was not previously expected because of their adjustments that they made in electronics. The company basically came out and said on the call, hey, there are a lot of secondary and tertiary electronics manufacturers, not name brand electronics manufacturers. That's affecting things. But again, it comes down to how you adjust to this. When you look at Best Buy and you look at their consumer electronics sales, obviously not going anywhere. When you look at Conn's consumer electronics sales, going down significantly. And again, part of this is because they're having to adjust for that consumer credit part. So that's one of the issues when you're a retailer that doesn't make money on the retail side of things. Sometimes having those secondary and tertiary products can mean bad news because you're not financing larger ticket items or larger dollar amount items for longer periods of time, and instead you're selling kind of the cheaper versions of things. They expect a change in same-store sales for the fourth quarter between -12% and -16%. So again, just a disastrous sales fall off. And you go back to Conn's and their whole thing is, well, we want to keep our revenues from financing portion of the business up. But again, they're just murdering same store sales in order to do so. And they expect these same store sales to fall even more so. An absolutely disappointing earnings call for those on Wall Street after Conn's had performed fairly well over the past couple of quarters. And you really wonder, you know, in a situation where people don't need financing a lot, given the state of the economy, are they more likely to go to Best Buy or Amazon or any other retailer for these consumer electronics products or other products in addition, rather than going to Conn's simply because they don't need that financing? And unlike the likes of Aaron's, let's say, they don't really have those third-party products to be able to bolster their overall company status. So I think all of this is a pretty negative sign for Conn's going forward. And, you know, again, they said in the call, producing positive same-store sales is a top priority of the leadership team, but they're not going to do that if it means being undisciplined in their credit strategy. All that being said, they do plan on continuing to open new showrooms. They opened 14 new showrooms in the last quarter. They expect to open 16 to 18 new showrooms in the next fiscal year, including their first locations in the state of Florida. So just something to look ahead to as far as Conn's is concerned. Still taken in balance, this earnings call, a somewhat negative one for retailers that, if you take the financing part out of the business, should be doing pretty well right now, given the overall economic landscape and given the success of other retailers in an atmosphere where we're seeing the likes of, say, Best Buy seeing nearly 2% comp store sales increases.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where H. Leighton and I talk about a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And we'll begin this week with Leighton.
Am I looking ahead, Trent? I'm looking at New Seasons Market, which is sort of a smaller grocer, but it would be a competitor of Whole Foods or Sprouts, any organic grocery out there or natural grocer. They have 21 stores in Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. So no stores where I live. I'd be curious to see one. The reason it's my looking ahead is they were just purchased by another retailer, Good Food Holdings. This company is actually a South Korea-based retailer. The Shinsei Group actually owns Bristol Farms, Lazy Acres, Natural Market, and Metropolitan Market. The reason it's my looking ahead is that they're going to be looking to actually use distribution from the other stores that they currently have in their portfolio. Like I just mentioned, Bristol Farms, for example, has a very large profile in the western part of the United States. And if you look at this merger, it's going to be changing, maybe potentially, the landscape of organic and natural food retailers on the West Coast. Reason being is they're going to be able to compete a little bit better on price, and they're going to be a little bit more down to earth, if you will. They're going to serve as more community hubs. They're going to have different things, for instance, farmers markets in their parking lots. They're going to be covering a lot more locally sourced products for their stores. And this is something we've talked about with Whole Foods over time, Trent, in that they do try to adjust a lot of their holdings store to store. So on an individual store basis, they try to have a certain percentage be locally sourced. But as you compete on price, naturally, you're going to stray away from this sort of concept, in that you're going to be focused more on keeping prices low in the face of competition coming from Walmart and Target, who really sources a lot of their products through national distribution chains. So they're going to be not looking at locally sourced products as much as some of these grocers. So I'm extremely curious to see how this growing New Seasons Market acquisition is going to play into the whole grand scheme of things. We're talking about a company with just over 20 stores, but if you're looking at some of the remarks made by the executives leading this transaction, you're looking at a lot of commitment statements, a lot of people saying that they are committed to not only growing this chain, but growing all of the stores and distribution networks that are going to be affected by this transaction. And I think it's interesting, in a time of compressed margins, Trent, where you're seeing, for instance, Sprouts on their latest earnings call, while still profitable, margins were deeply compressed and they're pulling back on plans to grow as fast as they have been over the last 2 to 3 years. And so you're wondering if this new competition, this ability to have pricing power over certain regional markets, is going to have a continued effect on the growth of other larger chains trying to either sustain or create more in the way of market share. And we're talking about not just Sprouts and Whole Foods, but also Natural Grocers, who has a big presence. And I was a local fan of, when I lived in the Midwest, a very nice chain there that was focused on primarily organic offerings. They didn't even want a lot of natural products, but still, you're looking at a lot of different chains. What this also tells me, lastly, Trent, my last comment on this, is that while margins have compressed significantly over time, and I'm sure they have for this concept in New Seasons Market as well, it is still a space where opportunity exists. It is a completely a viable option to differentiate and still have a margin and grow over time, which I think is just fascinating in an area, a space where you see a massive powerhouse like Kroger have net margins around 3%, calling that a major success. So a very tight market, but one that people are still not afraid to participate in.
Well, my looking ahead story has to do with the fact that in some parts of the country, we still haven't wrapped our heads around how properly to legislate selling wine, beer, and liquor in retail stores. And I mentioned on last week's show, actually Leighton mentioned briefly on last week's show, that Kroger stood to benefit from new relaxed liquor laws in Utah, allowing 5% ABV beer to be sold in Utah stores. Well, there's a caveat to that rule that to this point we haven't really mentioned. That caveat is that beer up to 5% alcohol by volume can indeed be sold in grocery and convenience stores, the likes of, you know, Target and Smith's and that type of thing. But from now on, once the rule came into effect on November 1st, the state-run liquor outlets, where previously you could get the ordinary beer that was out there can legally only sell beer that's over 5% alcohol by volume. Let that sink in. So that means your run-of-the-mill beers, or maybe a light Czech Pilsner, for example, or something like that, cannot be sold in those stores. You have to basically sell beers over 5% in those alcohol stores. So as time progressed towards that law, these liquor stores marked down a lot of these products. There are 106 beers in total included. Unfortunately, they didn't get rid of all of them, and so what ended up happening is about 275 cases of this discontinued beer that technically could be sold in grocery stores now but could no longer be sold to liquor stores, ownership couldn't be transferred because Utah, ended up getting destroyed, which overall cost about $18,000 of product. Now, again, looking at kind of a waste of money there, but it was interesting. They actually put a bunch of this beer in what's called a food digester to allow it to break down. This was just destroyed on Friday, December 13th. You might say, well, this looks like a looking back. Why is it you're looking ahead, Trent? Well, once again, when alcohol rules change in states, like the one you're seeing change in Utah right now, it forces retailers to change along with it. And the liquor store dynamics in Utah are a little bit different because, again, these are effectively state-sanctioned stores, these liquor stores. But the main reason it's my looking ahead is now that we've passed November 1st, now that these beers are kind of out of the way in the stores, how much advantage can Kroger, can Target, can the other retailers with a massive footprint in Utah take advantage of this rule? There are still a lot of very prohibitive liquor rules in Utah. You can't sell wine in grocery stores. You could go on and on and on with that. But how will these retailers take advantage of this in a market, by the way? Salt Lake City is one of the fastest growing markets in the country, and Smith's, which is the Kroger affiliate there, has a massive amount of market share along with Target and the likes of Whole Foods. So there's a lot for the taking here now that these rules are somewhat relaxed. Will it change? How much will it change? A lot of Utah breweries made beer specifically for supermarkets, maybe not have to do that anymore, but a lot going on in terms of those particular stores. And then also looking at the liquor and beer outlets themselves, what's the impact going to be with them? Is there going to be a perceived negative impact? In Colorado, the state where I live, again, they kind of rolled back some of the older alcohol laws to allow grocery stores to sell full-strength beer. Liquor stores were up in arms about it, but I haven't witnessed any liquor stores closing in the last year that that's been the case. So again, just kind of looking ahead to get the pulse on Utah to see exactly what can go on there. But again, it's just a reminder that a lot of areas of the country still haven't moved past prohibition era laws, which is head scratching considering we're about to turn the calendar to 2020. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. Once again, a big thanks to Rob McGovern for joining us on this week's show, and we'll be back about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.